From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made roughly 1 year ago when libertarians called for vaccines to be made available to the general public even before the trials were completed. Journalist Connor Friedersdorf explained recently, quote, "Given how many people now favor making vaccines mandatory, it seems like more people should have agreed with me back when I said, before FDA approval, that forbidding us from getting vaccines we already knew to be effective and wanted was a severe infringement on liberty," end quote. He continued, quote, "I don't think it's ideological hypocrisy to see forbidding someone access to a life-saving vaccine during a pandemic as a serious infringement," end quote. That sparked a discussion on libertarian ideology, when to allow access to medicine, how to evaluate healthcare policy, and then it moved beyond healthcare. Friedersdorf argues that on most of the major issues of the past two decades, starting with 9/11, libertarians were essentially right. He lists the war in Iraq, the extended occupation of Afghanistan, police reform, same-sex marriage, marijuana legalization, warrantless surveillance, and government-sponsored torture. And his readers raised the question, if libertarians have been right on so many issues, why aren't they growing their party or movement? Now, maybe you feel like this is an unfair description of the past two decades. Maybe you feel like libertarians have been wrong on more than they've been right. Well, this hour we discuss hindsight, libertarianism, and growing a movement. And our guests this hour, we're going to start with two. We'll have three eventually. Kevin Wilson is the host of a Free Solution radio program, former congressional candidate, among other titles. Kevin, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on again, Evan.
And Phil Rickey is with us. Phil is a former advisor for the Sharp for Governor campaign, former media director for the Johnson Weld campaign in 2016, former vice chair of the New York Libertarian Party. Phil, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Evan. Good to talk to you again.
All right. So, Kevin, were you just right on everything for the last 20 years? Is that right?
I'd like to think so, sure. But this guy, the challenging part is getting people to agree with me, though, and to act on it. And that's where the Libertarian Party has struggled. And you can see the results in my election. I did not win, did not do as well as I would have hoped. It's the unfortunate part about a lot of these issues is that I do think that libertarians are right about all these, but unfortunately, especially with things like the war on terror and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, fortunately, it cost the lives of many thousands of Americans and people in those countries before most of the country kind of woke up to the fact that maybe it wasn't a good idea to go to war overseas and to engage in imperialism.
Phil Rickey, do you feel like you've been right for the last 20 years and no one's listening?
Well, whether I feel it or not, my wife will correct me every time.
Jeez,
I would
Phil.
Say that out loud. I think that a lot of us come from a good place. I think, Evan, the problem is that, you know, at a time when most of these issues are very emotional, I think we come at this from a very unemotional place. We believe that people, you know, should have a right to live their lives the way they choose. We believe in, you know, not harming someone else. We look at things through sometimes a very pragmatic lens, and we're doing it at a time when emotions run really rampant. And it's easy to be Captain Hindsight and look back and be like, oh, look at how we knew it from the beginning. But the disconnect for the Libertarian Party has always been the ability to connect the heart and mind together and be able to talk directly to people in that way. And I just don't think it's something that the party has ever really learned how to do at a very large level. And because of it, we just keep on being the people who are right that no one's listening to. What I like to say is the loudspeakers in an empty theater, right? You know, great performances to nobody listening.
Lauren, let me bring in Lauren Hall, who is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at RIT, also an author. I know people are listening to you, whether it's students or your readers, whether they want to or not, Lauren.
Yes. Good to be here. No one has any choice. Yeah.
How do you feel about this framing that Friedersdorf, Matt Welch from Reason Magazine, they were weighing in on this. How do you feel about this framing that in many of the major issues of the last 20 years, libertarians are claiming, hey, we had it right all along?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's accurate. And I think, you know, one of the arguments that I would make is that I think the media doesn't do a good job of giving libertarians credit when they are, in fact, right. So if you look at, for example, the dialogue over same-sex marriage, libertarians supported that well before any major Democratic candidate ever got on board, right? Libertarians were arguing for marriage equality from the very not the very beginning, but the 70s. But nobody ever mentions that, right? It's become sort of part of the Democratic Party platform, but nobody ever says, hey, libertarians were screaming this into the skies for decades before that. So I think there's some media bias involved. But I also just think the political structure of the United States just doesn't really give us the ability to make a lot of headway because of the way that libertarians tend to sort of straddle the two dominant parties. There's issues that libertarians care about that resonate with Democrats, and then there's issues that libertarians care about that resonate more with Republicans. And that's really hard for the average American voter to understand. So there's a messaging problem, but there's also a structural problem that I think we're confronting.
Well, none of you will be surprised that I've got some feedback from listeners already who want to point out issues where they think you're wrong, and we'll tackle that going forward here. Before we do that, though, top of mind for me has been the way this country has evaluated what's happened in Afghanistan, and there's some things that sort of don't square up very much, but I do want to get all three of your take on this. So first of all, if you just look at the American political system as two parties, two dominant parties, this is a rare case where at least the last two presidents, the last president and the current president, agreed that it was time to get out of Afghanistan, even though presidents have been saying that for the last 20 years. The Trump administration did put some things in motion. They made an agreement with the Taliban. The Biden administration came in. They honored a lot of that, didn't deviate much. And the rhetoric from Donald Trump and Joe Biden was actually pretty similar about Afghanistan. So there was some agreement there. When it comes to the general public, this is a rare case of agreement that the vast majority of Americans have favored getting out of Afghanistan entirely. They favored that for a number of years. It's pretty strong numbers now. And what's really curious to me is that since the evacuation of Afghanistan, which started off catastrophically on August 15th and August 16th, but then culminated in more than 100,000 people evacuated before sort of the final accounting of it. Since that time, two things have happened. Joe Biden's approval numbers have gone down, perhaps in response to some of those sort of ghastly images that we saw and the bungling of the initial evacuation. But also the American public's support of being out of Afghanistan continues to be strong and has gone up. So if this is a case where libertarians were saying all along, you know, we ought not be there, or we shouldn't have gone in and started a war in Iraq, it has taken a while, but you have some coalescing here. The American media, the New York Times in 2000, in early 2003, the way they wrote about protesters, war protesters, is pretty hard to believe 18 years later. One of their headlines said that people were demonstrating against the United States trying to stop terrorism. I don't think that's generally what the protesters were saying, but that's how the New York Times characterized it. So we have seen a swing for sure on this. And I am curious to know, let me start with Professor Hall. What do you make of the political establishment's move on Afghanistan, the American public's view on this, and how policy gets shaped out of these lessons going forward, if you're confident that this will have any lasting effect on policy going forward?
Well, I won't guarantee that there will be any lasting effect on policy moving forward. I mean, I would hope that we would learn, but we had similar experiences in Vietnam. I mean, I think it just became an albatross, right? I mean, you had 20 years. And I think a lot of people were essentially at a point where if Afghanistan can't stand on its own feet, we can't keep doing what we're doing. And I think this demonstrates a general understanding within the academic community that the concept of nation building has really failed, and it's failed spectacularly. But in the early part of the 2000s, there was still, I think, some hope that nation building it was still controversial, but there was still some hope that it could be a legitimate activity and that you could actually build institutions. And this is something, by the way, that goes back in libertarian thinking all the way back to people like Adam Smith and lots of other people, Friedrich Hayek, who said, no, that's not how you can't impose institutions on other people. That's not how institutions grow. That's not how they develop. So part of the reason that libertarians were pushing back against this from the very beginning is that our very theory of how societies and communities work and develop pushes back against this idea. Now, Republicans and Democrats were, it took much longer for them to get on board, but I think it became clear after 20 years that we just were not going to be successful. And I think that was really what we saw. I mean, it wasn't a question of if the Afghan government was going to collapse, but a question of when. And so we knew that they would, that it would collapse within a couple months of the U.S. pullout. It turned out that it collapsed much, much quicker than anyone anticipated, but nobody was surprised that it did, in fact, collapse. So I think a lot of it has just been, I mean, you know, the academic view of nation building over the last 20 years has become very, very pessimistic. And so I think to a certain degree, policymakers have kind of followed that same trajectory, which is this is not going to work, and it probably never would have worked in the first place.
Okay, Phil Rickey.
Yeah, I'm going to go. I mean, I agree with everything Lauren just said, but I think there's an emotional toll to this. I'm going to go back to this for a second. When everything befell us with 9/11, there was anger, right? So going into Afghanistan mm-hmm. was fast. It was meant to be retaliatory. It was meant to go after, you know, this one group. There really wasn't, I think, any real long-term strategy built out. There wasn't any plan. What took its toll was Iraq happened, right? And Iraq was immediate. Iraq was an instantaneous failure. It was brought up on, oh, we're there because of weapons of mass destruction. We didn't find that. All this stuff. And what happened is there was a visceral reaction to that in the country. And Afghanistan became this background mission that was just going on. It wasn't that people ever supported or didn't support it. It just wasn't in the forethought of the average American. Iraq was in the forethought. It was a massive failure. Everyone used it in the 2008 election. It was the badge of pride that you didn't vote to go to Iraq. And I think what happened is after Iraq kind of came to a close, then there was this lingering issue of Afghanistan. And finally, it started becoming one of those things of, yeah, why are we still there? So I keep coming back to I agree with all of that. And from a policy standpoint, there's a lot of things that the average American doesn't think about. But it was emotional. This all came off of fear, of anger. And that's what got us there. And I think what kept us there for a really long time is that to what the professor was saying about trying to build nation building, trying to make this long term. But there was never a long term strategy. And the failure, the absolute failure and the quickness of that failure just demonstrates that. So I really think it just boils down to the fact that it was emotions that kept people focused on it. It wasn't really about policy.
OK, Kevin Wilson, what do you think?
Yeah, and adding on to some of that, you know, like just thinking back 20 years ago, there's overwhelmingly bipartisan consensus to go into the war. There's only one member of Congress who voted against going to Afghanistan. It's Barbara Lee. It wasn't Ron Paul, who's kind of famous for being anti-interventionist. The cost of that war is something that was easy for Americans to ignore. Although we've spent billions and billions of dollars and it's cost many lives, both American lives and the lives of people of Afghanistan, it became easy for that to fall into the background. And, you know, while libertarians talk about the cost of nation building, both culturally and financially, that didn't resonate emotionally with people who were angry about the attacks on September 11th and would easily get distracted by other issues coming to the forefront, including the Iraq war on the foreign policy side.
So what happens next then, Kevin? I mean, if there is a lesson here, I haven't seen Biden or Trump or any of their sort of acolytes say, well, we really should have just listened to libertarians on this. I haven't seen that. So what happens next?
No one's going to say that. What happens next is that, like, when there's an opportunity for another conflict to get involved in a situation that is civil war, to bring American troops to somewhere overseas, and we are still in several other places right now, I'll point out, but trying to keep those lessons to the forefront, say, hey, this is what happened in Afghanistan, this is what happened in Iraq, this is what happened in Vietnam, you know, this is why we don't want to do this. This costs too much money. This does not work. It costs American lives. We need to put a stop to it. So it's all we can do is try to reinforce the lessons of the past. And even if it comes in response to a situation where we may be angry, we have to look at what are the long-term consequences of this action, not just how do we feel in the moment right now? And it's really hard to separate ourselves from that.
Talking to Kevin Wilson, Lauren Hall, Phil Rickey, talking about the last 20 years in particular and some of the lessons that some prominent libertarians are asking the American public to see. So wading through some of the issues, Connor Friedersdorf was writing that if libertarians had been listened to on vaccines, we'd have seen even faster rollout and more opportunity to vaccinate a population beyond what we've already done here. So, Kevin, I'll go back across the panel. I'll start with you on this. What do you think should have happened with vaccines that didn't happen?
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to have seen that process fast-tracked. I mean, like, we're still in emergency use authorization for Moderna and for AstraZeneca. And, you know, I have to kind of question, like, well, what is the bureaucratic process that is causing this full approval to take so long necessary? And so, like, why does that need to happen? Because we could have saved thousands of lives by getting those vaccines out sooner, plus other things too, like rapid testing. Now, it's interesting because I know that there's a loud section of kind of the conservative and liberty movement who are now saying, like, well, no, we don't want government imposed vaccines and this doesn't have FDA approval. And I find that kind of odd now that there's a section of the movement that's saying that. But to me, I'm like, yeah, like I wanted to get this vaccine sooner. I would have loved to have gotten it last October. But yeah, it is what it is.
Phil, do you see it the same way? Do you see a system in which we could green light a vaccine that has not been, even if studies are not, the data isn't in, under the sort of the big label on the front that says, sign here if you're willing to forego, you know, sort of suing a company, et cetera. If you want to take a shot at this, you're in. I mean, is that overly simplifying the libertarian position on this?
I mean, it does. It is. But I mean, we're talking about it as if it's something that doesn't exist now. There's experimental trials happening on drugs all over the place that use that exact holds harmless agreements and things like that. And I know I'm oversimplifying it, but these processes already exist. So to say that they don't, you know, it's disingenuous. I think it's hysterical, the hypocrisy of the whole thing with vaccines. I've literally listened to people for years who say they don't trust anything the government does and everything like this. And now these are the same people that are saying it's experimental and you know, how dare we, you know, put non-FDA approved things in our body. Look, here's the thing. When everything happened with the pandemic, especially, Evan, there were two types of people that I was listening to. I was listening to economists who were talking about the economy and the effects of things. And I was listening to virologists and people who were brilliant at what they do to tell me what's safe, what isn't, what they're learning and what the data is showing. And I've had more than enough virologists tell me that these vaccines are safe. And I don't need an FDA approval to tell me that, because these are people who actually do this for a living and know it. And they all agree. And the consensus is great. And I've had enough economists tell us that a lot of the policies we've done have been catastrophic and supply is a mess and everything else like that. So I think it's really funny that we need these quote unquote stickers to be on there. And we use these stickers as our will to whatever fits our bubble to make it work. But at the end of the day, really smart human beings that we rely on to help us and to save us in this case did their job. And I think it's almost insulting to every one of them that we need all these other things to justify it. So I think it's probably one of the most hypocritical arguments that I've seen come out in a really long time by a lot of people.
Professor Hall, how would you have preferred to see the rollout of vaccines and the opportunity to receive vaccines go?
Yeah, I think we could have moved much more quickly. I think we could have certainly ramped up delivery. And I know somebody else mentioned testing. I mean, that was a huge problem early on, is that we were relying on government supply lines and government sort of supply bureaucracy to get tests. And as a result, the U.S. testing infrastructure was well behind other countries. So we couldn't even do basic things like contact tracing. So it was really difficult. And one of the things that's kind of interesting is that, I mean, at least from the campus perspective, we had a sort of free market approach in some ways, which is, you know, RIT and a bunch of other universities in the nation were some of the first organizations to deploy wastewater testing. Right. Let's just figure out who in this, you know, in this area has COVID, and then we can really narrow down testing from there. So private entities were actually doing a much better job testing populations than the government was. And I think, you know, there's lots of problems with the FDA. The FDA is not my particular area of research, but certainly during a pandemic, I think you're not just looking at questions of the safety of the vaccine. You always have to look at what the trade-offs are and what the alternative is. You had hospitals completely overwhelmed. You had morgues mm-hmm. in parking lots in New York City. It's not a question then of, you know, whether there might be long-term effects of this vaccine. If people want to get it, they should be able to, given that the alternative is ending up on a ventilator or stacked in a body bag in a parking lot in New York. So I do feel like there was a lot of very slow moving, and this is just a norm within the federal government. It's a very bureaucratic system. It's not meant to deal with pandemics. It's not meant to deal with climate change. It's not meant to deal mm-hmm. with any of these really quickly changing, rapidly moving kinds of targets. And I was just reading something today, you know, I mean, Bill Gates has just come out and said, you know, we're still not ready for the next pandemic. It'll come. The government won't learn. We'll do the same things that we did last time. So government by its nature is conservative in the small sense of the C word, right? It's a slow moving bureaucratic process. And so it's really not the best functioning process for thinking about how to handle these really quickly moving targets.
So let's talk about one more issue before we get to some listener feedback on where everyone thinks you're wrong, because we've been talking about where libertarians have been looking in the last two decades and saying, look, you're finally coming to where we were. That happened for sure on same-sex marriage, as you've all pointed out. It is happening on the legalization of marijuana and probably on the wider view that Americans have on drug wars, although there are differing views on different drugs. That could change over time. I don't know. Certainly it has with marijuana. It started with medicinal marijuana. Now we see many places, New York among them, going to full legalization. And so it's one thing to say yes, that a lot of people and politicians and left and right, they're getting to where you are in marijuana. But here's where I find some tension, and maybe you can help me. I think libertarians would agree that not only would libertarians say that the drug war has been a bad idea, but they have disproportionately targeted people, often by race, by income, that we've seen an incarceration of people at very, very high levels and deep disparities and injustices there. And because of that, what you have is a state like New York where you've got some elected leaders saying, okay, we're going to go towards legalization, but we've got some work to do to rectify some of those harms. And if we just threw this thing open to the free market, we would probably have no chance at fixing and sort of paying back some of the harm. So what we want to do, and the government's essentially saying, is we kind of want to grease the wheels here and put our thumbs on the scales and make sure that some of the people who are in the game first are from these communities that have historically been wronged by bad government policy, bad and unjust enforcement. So we've got to get our thumb on the scales here to make sure they have some redress. Otherwise, it's never going to happen. And so that's where I wonder where libertarians would be on that. Kevin Wilson, let me start with you. How do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds very well-intentioned. My worry with that program, is particularly the rollout in New York, is that it's going to end up doing a couple of different things. One, it's going to make it difficult for your average person, your average entrepreneur, to just go in and participate in the program. That they'll end up creating a bureaucratic system in which the exact communities that they're trying to help aren't able to then go and get the approval of the state mm-hmm. to go out and start selling, right? They're not going to be able to, you know, just be entrepreneurs. Some of the folks who are like, I mean, you know, it's going to sound a little bit controversial, but, you know, if they're out selling right now, like, why not just let them, like, go and keep going and start finding suppliers and become legit? And so that's my main worry, is that it ends up hurting. By creating extra barriers, they end up hurting the very communities that they say that they're trying to help.
Okay, I heard Professor Hall. Go ahead, Lauren.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, like, if you anytime you trust the government to put their thumbs on the scale, that their thumbs are going to support the people who are already entrenched in the system. We see this over and over again in healthcare. We see this over and over again in every single kind of regulatory process that I can think of. And this is particularly true in New York State. I'm doing work with entrepreneurial midwives and doulas on maternity care stuff. It's a completely tangled mess that absolutely privileges existing stakeholders, the really well-off. So what I think you're going to find, and we see this actually nationwide when we look at the effects of regulation, some of those effects are going to be consolidation. You're going to get people with special interests who come in, really early adopters, and they're going to very quickly use those regulatory hurdles against potential incoming folks, and you're going to have a big consolidated corporate system. And I think it's actually really ironic that one of the things that, you know, the American public is so against corporations, and they don't realize that one of the major causes of corporatization is, in fact, government regulations that privilege existing players and then the use of those regulations to keep other people out. So I think what you'll find is that the more that you have a bureaucracy and the same kinds of concerns I think that Kevin just brought up, right, it's going to be anti-entrepreneurial, it's going to be anti-small business owner. So as much as you say we really want this to go to people who are from vulnerable communities, those are precisely the people who aren't going to have access to this bureaucracy or they're going to be able to wade through it. And so it'll be the same people benefiting in a variety of complex ways, and you're going to get a consolidated corporate framework just like everything else in New York State.
Phil Rickey?
Well, I agree. I mean, I agree. And I agree with the intention, right? Like I love the intention. I think we've created messes in communities because of these laws, but it's 100% right. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at every single person or every single entity that is set up and ready for this, it's not entrepreneurs and small businesses that are getting the leg up. These are massive companies that have groves that they've been buying in other countries waiting for this legislation to get to where it is, right? And they're moving right in. So who benefits from these things? The people who have lawyers benefit from these things. The people who have lobbyists benefit from these things. It's not Doug down the street who wants to get in and start a business. Doug may be the beneficiary of one program, but it isn't going to be 20 Dougs or 30 Dougs. It's going to be a company that walks in that's already got about $10 million, $10 billion, whatever it is invested in this, and 20 lawyers that's going to be able to find their way into the market faster. And that's the nature of these programs. Look, every program, every system needs rules, and there are always good regulations. But in a free market, in a true free market, it does it itself. It really does create its own barriers. And what people hate, they don't hate corporatism. They don't hate free markets. What they hate is they hate cronyism. And cronyism comes from government well-intentioned programs that end up picking winners and losers. And the people who lose are the very people that are intended to help. And that's time and time again proven. And I always get it. I love it when people argue with me that one, because it's like, show me programs where it's actually benefited who you intended to benefit the majority of the time. And that doesn't show itself.
I can tell you that whether it's Senator Jeremy Cooney or others who've been on this program recently talking about this issue, they would disagree with our guests and say, we're going to get it right this time. Phil has said, show me the evidence. You got to laugh out of Professor Hall with that. But they said they're going to get it right this time, and they're going to make sure that communities that have been disadvantaged are at the front of the benefit of the benefits that come from this new law. We'll see. After we take our only break of the hour, we got to come back here. And Kevin Wilson, host of a Free Solution radio program on WYSL. He's a former congressional candidate. He's with us. Lauren Hall, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at RIT, is with us. Phil Rickey, who's a former advisor for the Sharp for Governor campaign, the former media director for the Johnson & Weld campaign, and the former vice chair of the New York Libertarian Party, is with us. And some of your feedback indicates where listeners think the Libertarians don't have a sterling record in the last 20 years. We'll take a look next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, vaccine mandates coming from the federal government. Now, there's an off-ramp here. Companies with 100 or more can have their employees tested if they don't want to get vaccinated. But will this kind of proposal stand up in court? We'll talk about it. Then we're talking about California's recall election and what it means. Talk with you on Wednesday.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thomas Seltzer is a designer and a writer who wrote that the reason libertarians have not been growing a movement is not necessarily their policies of the last 20 years. I mean, he might give some ground and say they were right on the wars or on the drug wars, on equal marriage and other issues. But Thomas Seltzer writes, you can compare Republican and Democratic leaders to a libertarian policy, but you are conveniently not comparing them to libertarian politicians. Ron Paul, Rand Paul, Vermin Supreme. That last one is an actual candidate, not a characterization of the first two. It's true, Vermin Supreme is a real person. And so what Seltzer is saying is that you've got a little bit of a, it's a kind of a clown car, and it doesn't look very serious. And so Kevin Wilson, I know you've heard that before, but he says that's why the Libertarian Party is not taken very seriously. You haven't attracted serious people. What would you say to that, Kevin?
All right, so I will defend Vermin Supreme slightly. I think he's hilarious. But I know not everyone shares that opinion. Not everyone gets a job. I think he's funny as heck. But anywho, I think we do attract serious candidates. I mean, I was running for Congress. I'd like to think that I presented serious policy when on this show and on other programs. Gary Johnson is a former governor. Bill Weld, former governor of Massachusetts, was running in 2016. You know, we've run a lot of people. And in fact, in 2020, the Libertarian Party ran a state candidate that we won our first state level office out in Wyoming. Now, there are unserious candidates in the Democratic and the Republican Party, too. You can find plenty of examples of those. And the handful of unserious ones that end up kind of making it to the media doesn't discredit their entire party. With the Libertarian Party, people love to pick on, the handful of examples, run with those, and then ignore all the people doing the hard work and talking about serious issues and trying to work towards liberty and giving people more choice and opportunity in their communities at every level of government.
Okay. Lauren Hall?
Yeah, I'll just defend. I mean, I totally agree. I think we actually have a lot of really thoughtful people out there. But there is a structural barrier to the Libertarian Party really gaining a lot of ground, and that's the two-party system. So you're going to have a really hard time attracting people who are going to give up their day jobs to run for office if they know that the system is rigged against them, because we don't have things like ranked choice voting. We don't have alternatives to the current win or lose kind of binary. So of course we're not going to have the same kind of diversity of candidates, the same kind of people with elite backgrounds. So I actually think we've done really well for ourselves. The other thing that I'll say, given that we have those structural barriers, is that a lot of the most interesting work that's being done, I think, in academia, particularly in academic philosophy, for example, is actually happening among libertarians. So there's an enormous collection and network of serious, thoughtful libertarian academics, serious, thoughtful libertarian journalists who are doing really excellent work. So again, when we focus on people like Vermin Supreme, I think we're really ignoring the sort of depths of the network. But I will say that I think that Libertarian Party has not done as good a job of developing a bench, meaning these, tackling local and state elections. That's changing, and so that's probably a good sign. But right now, there aren't the incentives for people to really give up everything to run for public office under the libertarian banner. And then the final thing I'll mention, of course, is that when you have a deep distrust of government, a lot of libertarians don't think that the best thing they can do with their time is run for public office and work for the government.
Okay, Phil Rickey, what do you think?
I think this country elected Donald Trump president, and that in of itself makes me say that we should stop looking at libertarians and saying what they could do better. So I'm sorry if that's not funny in its sadness. Like, you had a guy that literally was a billionaire who bankrupted himself. He lies more than he talks, or every time he talks. He was president of this country, and that came through one of the two major parties. And, I've worked with a lot of libertarians over the years, man. I'll tell you, they're funny. Vermin Supreme, he's a nice guy, but he wears a boot on his head. It's weird. Like, it's just that simple. It's weird. But the guy that got elected president and got 70 million votes last time around was that guy. So I'm sorry that I'm not willing to be as judged as hard as everyone wants to judge us. It's just, it's weird. Sorry.
That's That is a little bit of a mic drop. I have to give Phil that. Okay, Let me get Chris in Rochester on the phone. Hi, Chris.
Yes. Hello, Evan and guests. I think something that often gets overlooked by Americans when they think of libertarian party domestic policy anyway, is the degree to which they do not like public spending on the welfare state. Traditionally, such programs as food stamps, public assistance, subsidies for Amtrak, passenger rail, subsidies for health care for people who meet certain income guidelines. I happen to think we need government intervention in many areas of the economy, that the free market does not have the answer for everything. I mean, let's take a look at Amtrak passenger rail, for example. It's pretty sad compared to the high-speed passenger rail systems that exist in Germany and France and Spain and Japan, all of which get massive government subsidies. So, you know, another area would be regulation of the food industry to be sure that the food that is packaged for us is safe. So that brings up Rand Paul, libertarian congressman from Kentucky. He's a self-professed libertarian. I would really like to know whether he voted for the American Rescue Plan that Biden rolled out, which extended unemployment.
Well, probably not. Yeah.
And, okay, so I won't say any more, but there you have it.
Okay, thank you, Chris. So let me actually key in on one thing that Chris is saying there, because there's a lot there. And I'll start with Phil on this. But Phil, Ricky, when we talk about what government's capable of, libertarians love to say government is cumbersome, it's slow, it doesn't respond quickly, it performs poorly in the marketplace, and that we need to just throw the restrictions off and let the private sector do this. And what Chris is pointing to is the slowest, most cumbersome, annoying, sorry, Amtrak, train system in the world, which is Amtrak, which I would love to ride more trains, but I never even know if this company even knows if there's another train on in front of it. And then you go to Europe, and there's a whole lot of government subsidy and ownership going on there, and those things fly, and they are on time. So how did that happen, Phil?
We have roads and other means of transit in which we've invested more money into and the people have chosen to take, right? I mean, really what it boils down to is if you look at our airports, if you look at our roads, if you look at our interstate transit, we've invested more money in other means and people have decided that is the means in which they want to take things. I think there hasn't been enough investment or willingness to invest in that. There's been a lot of speculation, a lot of talk, and a lot of well-wishing around Amtrak and all the rail systems, but it apparently hasn't done enough to drive investors to do it. And because it hasn't driven enough investors to do it, it hasn't been improved. It's really, I don't want to oversimplify it, and I'm sure the other guys can go deeper in it, but at the end of the day, we made our investments in other ways. We get better travel faster in other ways, and the Americans choose to use other means of transit. And I think that's why it's the way it is.
Kevin Wilson, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, and I will point out that Amtrak does get subsidies from the government too. But I mostly agree with Phil's point. And, you know, I do want to add on that just because the caller mentioned something about like the food inspection stuff, just because the government does something doesn't mean that it would not exist without the government doing that thing. Right. There's nothing to say that like we couldn't have private agencies already looking at food. In fact, we do that with food in particular, with things like kosher food. Right. You can see all the labels on the food in other companies, inspect that food, give their certification, and people trust that for their dietary needs for their religion. So the same thing could apply across many different areas. Just because the government doesn't oversee that thing doesn't mean that that service isn't going to exist in the government's actions.
Okay, and Professor Hall, if you want to add to that, you can. I also know, you know, Chris was just weighing in and saying he believes that libertarian ideology has ignored people who are truly suffering, for whom there is no safety net.
Yeah, can I just, I just want to make a couple of comments.
Sure.
First of all, I think that there's a couple things going on that are real confusions about the libertarian platform. First of all, the idea that there's this binary between the government and the market, that if it's not government doing it, it has to be the market. And somebody just pointed out that that's actually not true. We have civil society. Mm-hmm. We have lots and lots of various organizations and communities and lots of people doing different kinds of things to sort of effectively protect people within their communities. There's lots of examples of this, right? I use Consumer Reports when I'm trying to buy an appliance because it's a really good non-governmental, essentially a kind of regulatory body, right? It's a quality control mechanism. Now, it doesn't have the coercive power of the state, which I actually like. So there's all sorts of people doing that kind of work. I think part of the problem with the sort of government versus market binary is that we really lose the opportunity to see how we could create really innovative systems. The other thing that I'll mention is that there's always these comparisons between the U.S. and Europe. These are completely apples and oranges comparison. The reason that we don't have one of the reasons we don't have high-speed rail in the United States is that it's a gigantic country of 100 million, 300 million people. We don't have the same population centers as Europe. We don't have a situation in which you have, you know, Paris that you could get to in an hour from, you know, New York or whatever the situation is, right? So Europe is a much more population-dense geographic region, and so high-speed rail works. The same thing is true of Japan. Maybe we could have better systems along the eastern seaboard. That's absolutely true. But as other people have pointed out, Amtrak gets a lot of government subsidies, right? And so Americans like cars for a variety of cultural reasons, one of which is the geographic situation that that Americans are in. The other thing that I'll just mention, whenever people bring up, you know, comparisons of the U.S. and other countries, especially Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, for example, is that those countries are actually much, much higher on economic freedom indices. They're much higher on libertarian principles in a variety of areas. So they're much more open to free markets. They're much more open to free trade. And so when we say, oh, libertarianism can't work because obviously, you know, Denmark has better quality of life. Well, wait a second. No, Denmark might actually have better quality of life because they're more free market than we are. So there's a lot of confusion about the kinds of systems that we're comparing ourselves to. And the U.S. is not, in fact, a free market system. It's a cronyist system, as other people have pointed out. We use regulations in a variety of ways to actually crack down on market activity. So again, I think this sort of weird vision that people have that the United States is this like market dystopia, they don't really understand what free market principles are. And in fact, there's many European countries that are much higher on economic freedom indices, and those are the ones that we should actually look to.
All right, a couple of the main points of pushback. Let me read two emails. I'll start with this one. This is from Andrew. The libertarian ideology to starve the so-called beast of government has crippled government capacities over decades and thus eroded the perceived competence and trust in government by the public, not to mention denigrating the perception of public servants and no doubt preventing some of our best and brightest from pursuing careers in government. Further, their individual freedom dogma is exactly what's keeping Americans from recognizing the interdependence and sense of shared fate that might encourage more vaccination and mask wearing. Libertarianism might work when the economy is strong and when you are in a position of privilege, but to claim that a libertarian-led pandemic would have led to faster responses and fewer deaths defies reason. Professor Hall, let me start with you on that one. What do you think?
Well, again, I'm a political theorist, and I've been studying classical liberal political philosophy for the last 15 years, and there's no serious libertarian or classical liberal thinker who does not focus on the importance of interdependence or the importance of community. I study Adam Smith. I study Friedrich Hayek. All of these people are fundamentally concerned with how humans live together in communities and take care of one another. And I'll add on to the comment from previously about the question of, you know, what to do about the vulnerable. Again, libertarians have been trying to think about alternatives to the bloated welfare state. There's a really dynamic conversation within libertarian communities right now about the basic minimum income and thinking about ways to provide people with more freedom, getting them out from under the thumb of having to wrestle with issues like food stamps, and instead giving them what they actually need, which is an income, right? So the idea that libertarians are just ignoring poverty or ignoring, you know, just trying to dismantle the welfare state or, you know, bleed the beast of government without offering real, you know, policy alternatives, is that's just not actually what's going on in the real policy conversations that actual libertarians are having. So I don't think that any of that is accurate. I think when people start pushing back is when they stop trusting the government. And so I agree that the pushback that we've seen against things like mask mandates and vaccine mandates is very, very concerning. But I think a lot of that comes because the government itself has undermined itself. We have not seen the idea that libertarian thought has somehow destroyed our trust in government. Like, what? The government has been making horrific mistakes for the last 200 years. We certainly don't need libertarians to point those out.
Okay, Phil Rickey, go ahead next.
Yeah, everything that is written in there makes me laugh, because it's this weird assumption that it's been libertarians that have been running everything. Like, if you just listen to the way that all comes across, as we've made all these. Okay, listen, fundamentally false. You haven't had a libertarian ideology doing anything. If you did, you wouldn't have half the problems that you have today. And the reason why is because one thing that every libertarian, whether you are a little L, and that's me, I'm like the professor there, I'm a classical liberal, that's where I do a lot of my my belief structure in it, or even a big L, is that it all comes down to consent. So libertarians make some of the best socialists. They take care of each other. They pool resources together. They help. They lift each other up. It's just done consensually. And consensually just means is that there's a shared vision and a shared caring of community. And that has always been something in any libertarian circle that I've ever been a part of, or anyone that I know always thinks that way. Libertarians have not been in charge of anything. So your writer that put that has to get something really clear. You've had not a libertarian philosophy dominant in this country. You've had a very authoritarian dominating in this country of a thought process. Things that are being dictated and told and pushed down, and it does it all by emotion, whether it's perpetrating on anger or fear or people's compassion, but it has all been where policy has been coming from up high to down low. So this is not a libertarian philosophy. Libertarians are not the ones that are fighting against fighting against vaccinations. That is not the case at all. So I think the entire conversation in which that was based off is just intellectually dishonest, and it's just wrong. It's based in fallacy, not fact.
Okay, Kevin Wilson.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Phil said and Professor Hall said. No, I mean, if anything, like, it, not only have we not had a libertarian response to the pandemic, as we pointed out, I worry about a growing illiberalism both on the right and left in their mm-hmm. approach to government. But so that's my big concern is that everyone that is in politics right now wants to feel like they want to be the hero. They want to provide the solution. They want to be the one to solve the problem. And we need more humility in politics to say that there are smart people out there, not in government, that are acting privately, that have these solutions that should be allowed to do that on their own. But oftentimes the government ends up providing a barrier to that.
Well, last question from listeners. This is from Roger and Joel, both wrote right in saying that libertarians have been a principal impediment in terms of this ideology to coming up with solutions for climate change. And Roger says, are any libertarians reconsidering their support for the freedom to burn unlimited fossil fuels? Kevin Wilson.
I think that we should make it easier to build nuclear power plants, and states like New York should stop shutting down nuclear power plants. Like, that is the most scalable carbon-free solution to providing energy that we have. And really, if state and national level decisions weren't impeding that progress, we'd make a lot of progress towards climate change.
Okay, Phil Rickey.
Yeah, I believe wholeheartedly that there should be alternative and clean energy out there, and that we should be helping that along, just like oil and gas companies were helped along until the technology became stable. And we should have a lot of different choices for people to be able to choose from and to be able to lower the overall impact on our green economy. So, yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Professor Hall?
Yeah, I don't think I have much to add. I think, you know, getting rid of the subsidies that we had on coal and oil. But also, I mean, and this is another area where I think you see anti-science bias on both sides of the aisle. The nuclear question, I think, is really clear. It's a clean and safe option that has been just taken off the table for a lot of complicated political reasons.
But Professor Hall, what do you say to those like Joel, like Roger, who are concerned that with a libertarian sort of governing philosophy, the incentive would be mostly for status quo, that we would not see a significant change in our habits, and without that change, we're in real trouble?
Again, I think that assumes that people think that all action in society comes from the government. There's enormous pressure from the bottom up, homeowners trying to change their patterns of consumption, corporations trying to become more green. There's an enormous sort of sea change here. So the idea that you need the government to make any kind of substantial change in one direction or another, I think we're seeing very clearly, especially now given the partisanship within Congress, that the government's not really capable of doing much at all. We can't get bipartisan agreement on almost anything. So why not actually let markets and let really, you know, talented entrepreneurs take a larger role? I think, again, we're falling into this sort of binary that if the government doesn't do it, no one will.
Lauren Hall is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at RIT. Professor, thanks for making time for the program today.
It's always great to be here, Evan.
Phil Rickey, former advisor to the Sharp campaign, the Johnson Weld campaign, former vice chair for the New York Libertarian Party, and a traitor who moved to the Midwest. Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, there. I never go on.
And Kevin Wilson, host of a Free Solution radio program. Where can people find that program, Kevin?
You can find it at A Free Solution on Facebook or YouTube.
A Free Solution is the program. We appreciate the time, Kevin. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me on.
From the whole team at Connections, Rob Braden, Megan Mack, Emma Ray Stein, Evan Dawson saying, have a nice afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.